The Laundries are back. Less than 2 days after Brian Laundrie's parents fled their home to, quote, grieve privately, they are back at the little yellow house. But there's something very different about that red truck. We're going to show you what it is and why it might just matter. Connecting the dots in the Alec Baldwin deadly shooting, who should pay for the death on the set? Will the crew be charged? Will the actor be himself? Will anyone go to jail? It has happened before. Sarah Jones was killed because of safety lapses on the set. Her father joins us tonight. And later, he's been fired, charged, jailed, shamed, and suspected of killing his own wife and son. But for Alex Murdoch, the worst may be yet to come, and it may be coming Friday. We'll get a preview tonight on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield. New developments in the Brian Laundrie investigation. We thought the Laundrie house might stay dark for a while, but that familiar red truck turned into the driveway just a few hours ago, and out stepped Brian's parents, Chris and Roberta Laundrie. It was unexpected because we were told they had left to grieve the death of their son, Brian. But 5 days after Brian Laundrie's remains were discovered in the Florida Nature Reserve, we're all still searching for answers. And now we have more questions than we had before. To help answer some of those questions, I'm joined on the phone by News Nation's Brian Enten. He's on the phone because he's headed to Wyoming to continue this investigation. That's where the Gabby Petito investigation has yet to name her killer. So, Brian, this was a big surprise. We did not expect to see the Laundries back. I'm sure you're surprised as well.
Yeah, Ashley, I thought that they would be gone for a longer period of time. You know, Steve Bertolino, the attorney, told us that they were in an undisclosed location in Florida and they were grieving. So I thought they would be gone maybe a week or so, or maybe even longer. When they left, we saw Roberta with the backpack. We saw Chris Laundrie put some boxes in the back of the truck. So again, most of us out there thought they would be gone a while, but now suddenly they were back this afternoon, and now they're back at the house.
So, Brian, it might look like not much. A red truck pulls up, two people get out, they walk past their camper. They've got, you know, what looks like maybe just weekend bags, and they head back into the house. No word to the press that's there, no acknowledgement of the press that's there. But you and your cameraman, Luis, noticed something intriguing about the truck. What was it?
Yeah, well, we've been there for so long, we notice like every little thing that's different. But this was something that we noticed right away. On the red truck, there were these black clips before because, you know, they used that truck with that camper that they would put on top of the truck. And those black clips were now gone when the truck returned back to the house. We're not exactly sure why. They were pretty identifiable, so perhaps they took them off because they thought people wouldn't notice the truck as much and know that it was them. But it's interesting, those black clips that connect the camper to the truck are now gone.
Is it possible that they're now looking to perhaps sell the truck or maybe sell the camper, knowing full well maybe they're not going to put that camper top back on? Is it possible that they're maybe looking for some extra liquidity at this point?
It's possible. And it's interesting, we're now talking about the camper because just yesterday I spoke with the man who sold them that camper, and he lives on the other side of Orlando, about 4 hours away from Northport. Basically, and I confirmed all this, he actually had a receipt and everything, and he had Chris Laundrie's signature, and he still has the check. But basically, just sort of a side note, Chris and Roberta Laundrie bought that camper back in August. They paid $7,000 for it, according to the person who sold it to them. He took a $1,000 down payment. They paid the other $6,000 with a check that actually bounced. So they didn't receive the camper right away. They ended up paying for it in cash a few weeks later. But kind of interesting that that's where the camper came from.
Okay. There was something else that happened today, Brian, that I think was a shock. to all of us, especially those of us who report this story every day, you included, and that was that the Northport Police Public Information Officer Josh Taylor gave yet another interview. This one was to WFLA, that's a local station in Florida, and said the following, and you're just going to have to bear with me here. I'm going to quote Josh Taylor, even though this doesn't sound like it's coming from the police. It says that the case of mistaken identity regarding Roberta Laundry and her son, Brian Laundry, quote, likely changed nothing because, quote, there's a very good possibility that Brian was already deceased. So let's just keep those words up on the screen, okay? This refers to Roberta Laundry coming home in the Silver Mustang. That was on the 15th, the Wednesday of the week from hell, 2 days after Brian went missing. Not only did the Northport police miss Brian backing out of the driveway in the Mustang on his way to what would eventually be his grave site, but they determined that the person driving the Mustang back into the driveway was Brian and not his mother. So we'll just put those two people up side by side on the screen to see how remarkably different they are. A woman in her late 50s to early 60s who wears flouncy tops and tights often and is rather short. And Brian, who is a man, tall and skinny and bald with a beard, who does not wear those flouncy tops and does not look a thing like his mother. I'm sorry, but you don't need to be an expert to determine that is not Brian getting out of that truck. So, Brian Enten, what do you make of this comment to WFLA that this business about mistaking Roberta for Brian, quote, likely changed nothing because there's a very good possibility that Brian was already deceased?
Well, the mistaken identity comment, we talked about that last night, Ashley. I mean, that surprised me. I wasn't expecting to hear Josh Taylor say that. In terms of the part where he's now saying, well, we don't think our mistake would have really changed anything anyway, he's actually told me that many times before. Whenever I talk to him about the mistakes that were made and the issues within the police department along the way, he sort of pointed that out, that yes, they're going to look into these mistakes and how they happened, but, you know, he believes that the outcome would not be different because they believe that Brian Laundry very well may have been dead even before all of this time frame that we're talking about right now.
So what bothers me about it was I have been waiting on pins and needles for an autopsy result for a cause of death, a manner of death, a time of death, which usually comes after an autopsy, or in this case, will likely come after the entomologists and the anthropologists have had their look at his skeletal remains. But somehow, Josh Taylor has determined there's a very good possibility that Brian was already deceased 2 days after he went on his walk. And for that, I am gobsmacked. How on earth could the Northport police know that at this early stage, Brian?
Well, based on my conversations with Josh Taylor, I think that they believe there is a probability, and he has told me that there is a very good likelihood that Brian Laundry committed suicide. And while we don't know that yet from the medical examiner, Josh Taylor has said that. So when he makes these comments about the fact that, well, things wouldn't have really changed even though we made these mistakes, I think that's what he's referring to, that Brian Laundry may have gone out into the swamp days before this and taken his own life. And regardless of the mistakes that the police made with the surveillance, that wouldn't have really changed anything. Again, we don't have the official cause of death yet. They don't know that for sure, unless there's some kind of information that we don't know about yet, perhaps something that they've seen in the notebook that they haven't told us. But I believe that is what Josh Taylor is referring to.
The notebook. I'm waiting again on pins and needles for that from the FBI. But I will tell you that 2 days after that young man right there on your screen went for a walk that turned into a deadly episode and ended up as a gravesite. I don't ever want to hear a police officer say, no big deal, because that guy shouldn't be dead. That guy should be perhaps locked up and answering questions as to the death of Gabby Petito, because somebody put their hands around her and killed her. And we all deserve to know if it was him. And he also deserves to be punished for it. So for the police to say, no biggie, I'm sorry, I beg to differ. One other question, Brian. There has been a lot of talk on social media. There have been rumors and reports that have gone like wildfire today about people believing that there somehow a DNA result has come back and that the DNA in question doesn't match the skull, that it's not Brian, that he's somehow still out there. And I want to read for you some of the social media that we pulled based on this. Tara asks, any word about this news saying the DNA doesn't match? And then Lauren asks, he's still alive. His DNA doesn't match the skull found. Well, that's not really a question. That's more of a statement. Greg asks, do you have a confirmed report that DNA does not match? And lo and behold, yes, Brian Enten, you have the answer.
Yeah, so this spread like wildfire, this conspiracy theory. I'm not exactly sure how it started, but there were so many people online saying, oh, it's true. There's these fake news websites that had it reported that the DNA did not match the skull. The medical examiner has now come out today and said that is not true. What the medical examiner said is that no DNA analysis on Brian Laundrie's remains has been performed yet. So they haven't even done the DNA analysis. That samples will be submitted for DNA testing once the examination of the remains is complete. The remains were confirmed to be Brian by using dental records. So you mentioned the anthropologist. They're still waiting on the scientists to go over the bones and see what they can figure out. Then they will send the bones for the DNA testing at that point. But they're very, very confident that they have confirmed the identity by using the dental records. So there's just absolutely no truth to that rumor at this point.
Okay, and just so everybody sees it, let's put that statement from the medical examiner up on the screen. It's from the District 12 ME who did Brian's autopsy, saying the identity of the remains found at the Carlton Reserve on October 20th was confirmed by comparison to known dental records of Brian Laundrie. No DNA analysis has yet been performed on the remains. Samples will be submitted for DNA testing once the examination of the remains by the medical examiner's office is complete. So let's put that one to bed. I need to do some other reading for you, Brian, because we still have a lot of questions about the Gabby Petito investigation, because we still would like to find out what did the FBI and all other investigative bodies find out about the killing? And did they determine it was going to be a murder? Did they have a prime suspect? We're still left in limbo. The case is still open. So I wrote to the FBI today, to a contact that I have there, and I'm going to tell you the exact email. I'm going to show it to you. I said, I'm wondering if I can chat with you about the FBI process in the Petito case. Conventional wisdom would suggest that the case is wrapping up and about to be closed. Any chance I could speak with the agents on the case to discuss when they might be willing to reveal some of the investigative product? And the answer that I got was pretty concise. And this is what it said. Thank you for the inquiry. There will not be any interviews at this time. So never one to give up easily, I emailed back. And I said, I'm really just wondering more about the process and when we can determine if or when the case will be closed regarding Gabby Petito. Is that something you can help me at least plan through? And I got another very concise reply from the FBI in Denver. I do not have more information at this time, but we'll certainly provide updates as they're available. So I'm not getting much. So, Brian, stand by for 1 second. Don't go anywhere, Brian. I want to now bring in the former assistant director of the FBI Criminal Investigations Unit, Chris Swecker. He is also joining me by phone. Okay, Mr. Swecker, when you were Agent Swecker, was this weird? To me, it seems a little unnecessary now that what seems like the prime suspect is dead and gone. But can you walk me through the process right now?
Yeah, good evening, Ashley. I think that the FBI is good. We're very close to getting the answers from them. I do think that they don't have the same burning bridge urgency they would have had if Brian Laundrie were alive or on the run or presented a danger to the public. So I think they're taking their time to get it right. They owe answers to the family and frankly, to the public. But I think there's probably still some forensics pending. The things like hairs and fibers that may have come from the body of Gabby Petito or the area where she was found, maybe matching that with the forensics from where Brian Laundrie was found. Maybe I think that type of thing takes some time. There are probably some electronic evidence that needs still to be gone through or retrieved. Some of the carriers are very slow in pulling that information from the cloud. So I'm not making excuses for the FBI. We need them to move on with some dispatch here. But I don't think they're pushing this as they would. I think they may be focusing in as much on whether the parents are culpable criminally as opposed, to the full details of the homicide.
So it's basically crossing all T's and dotting all I's, not just with regard to the dead suspect, Brian Laundrie, but potentially any connection or any collaboration or any other kind of aiding and abetting potential for the parents. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing to be gained by putting anything out there publicly, because they'll test anything the parents may say or any alibis or any rationales that they may put forward against what they know from all the evidence they've collected. So there's no point in putting it out in the public and tipping them off.
So then should I suggest, Chris Wecker, that I just need to hold my horses? Like, this is not unusual and that we should all just be really patient, because I don't like that, right?
Yeah. No, nothing about this case is normal. There's been quite a few twists and turns that even I've been surprised about it as well. But yes, the answer is they're going to work at their pace. I don't think they're going to work at to satisfy the news machine. I think they're going to make sure that they get everything right. They don't have to go into court and prove beyond a reasonable doubt on the homicide, but they would have to do that with any criminal charges against the parents, which I think they're looking very hard at that right now, and they don't want to jeopardize any prosecution there. I saw your extraordinary interview with the attorney, and I was fascinated that it even went on. But I there's some things in there that to me generate new questions, and you hit on it, the timelines and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, it's not the last I'm going to be calling on you, sir, for some analysis, because I think the next part of the story is certainly coming from the FBI out of Denver that's coordinating that investigation. And I know it's only bank fraud, but I know it's also more than that. And they just work, like you said, at their pace, and they're real quiet. Thank you, Chris Wecker. I know you have to run. Otherwise, I'd keep you for the whole hour. You know me. Brian Ench, are you still on the phone with me?
Yep, I'm still here, Ashley.
Okay, good. I didn't want to let you go right away because you're going to do something tomorrow. I know. So we're going to share the secrets right now for the audience, because they want to know where you are when you're on the phone. They're like thinking, what's going on? He's traveling. Brian is, I think are you in Wyoming yet? Are you you're headed there. Did you get there yet?
So we're in Moab, Utah.
Okay.
You remember where the incident happened between Brian and Gabby, the body cam incident, kind of where this all began. We're in Moab right now, and we're going to be traveling up to Wyoming to Grand Teton.
Got it. Okay. And so when you get there, we're going to, continue to do this reporting of this second part of the story that we're clearly looking for. But, Brian, I want to roll a quick piece of tape about something that you did before you left Florida. You met some people, as you do, and you found out something very fascinating about them. Not just one, not just two, lots of people who have decided to get on airplanes or do massive long road trips to be, for lack of a better term, crime tourists. I want to play a quick moment of that, and I'm going to ask you a quick bit on the other side. Take a look at this.
What surprised me, having watched it on TV for weeks, what surprised you the most, would you say, about being here? Is there anything you noticed that you thought was different?
The size of that reserve is mind-boggling. I mean, you can't get an idea of how big that thing is.
So, Brian, tomorrow you're going to talk a little more about the people that you met and the lengths that they've gone to and the groups, the Facebook groups they belong to sort of come and be a part of the story, right?
Yeah, I've met so many of these people, for the last 5-6 weeks in Florida, especially in the last week, since something about when Brian Laundrie was found dead, more and more people wanted to come. And it's interesting, you've got these at-home sleuths, but you've also got people that want to actually visit the sites. And there are people that I met who, you know, wanted to, you know, they wanted to go to the Laundry House. They wanted to go to the Carlton Reserve. They wanted to go to Cassie's house. They wanted to go to Northport PD, almost like a tour, which it sounds strange, but when you talk to them, you realize they're just so into the case. This is really what they want to do in their spare time.
I don't blame them. I am too. If I didn't have to be attached to the desk every night, I'd be right down there with you and then off to Wyoming with you too. Brian, safe travels, okay? You and Luis, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I told Luis the same thing. I'm like, you know, people kind of judge these people, but we sort of get our curiosity out through our job because we're doing it every day. But for these folks, like the couple you just saw there, they flip houses for a living. So this is sort of their side thing that they just enjoy researching and going out to places like this, you know?
I think it's fascinating. I can't wait to meet these folks. And I think they have a lot of people probably watching tonight that connect with them on Facebook as well. So, Brian Enten, like I said, you and Luis drive safely. Be careful. And I can't wait to talk to you about your the next leg of your reporting, sir. Thank you. Coming up, what happened right before the fatal shooting on the set of the Alec Baldwin film Rust? The editor-in-chief of The Wrap says there was incredibly reckless behavior with the guns on the set, including the one that fired the fatal shot. She joins me next. We have breaking news tonight. The New York Times is reporting that the Santa Fe County District Attorney says she's not ruling out criminal charges after the fatal shooting on the set of Alec Baldwin's film Rust. And the list of possible suspects responsible for the shooting is now growing. We have just learned that even more people may have handled the gun right before Alec Baldwin fired the shot that killed cinematographer Helena Hutchins and wounded the film's director, Joel Souza. I want you to follow the path of the gun with me. Alec Baldwin was handed the gun by the assistant AD. That's the assistant director. His name is Dave Halls. Halls allegedly shouted "cold gun" right before handing that weapon to Baldwin. And in the, you know, industry, cold gun means it is safe to use. There's nothing in the chamber. Remember that. Nothing. Sadly, that was not true. And this was not the first time that Halls has been involved in a gun-related accident on a film set. CNN is reporting in 2019, Halls was the assistant director on the movie Freedom's Path when a gun unexpectedly discharged, injuring a sound crew member. That crew member sought medical treatment, missed work, and Halls was fired. But just 2 years later, it was Halls who handed the loaded gun to Alec Baldwin. It doesn't look good, especially when you listen to this 911 call that was placed by Rust's script supervisor, putting the blame for the Baldwin shooting squarely on Dave Halls.
This that yelled at me at lunch because asking about revisions. This mother did you see him lean over my table and yell at me? He's supposed to check the guns. He's responsible for what happened in the
Halls reportedly retrieved that deadly weapon from a prop cart that contained three guns prepared by the film's armorer. That person is 24-year-old Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, who'd only been an armorer on one other film before this one. And she even discussed her lack of experience on a podcast called Voices of the West last month.
I was really nervous about it at first, and I almost didn't take the job because I wasn't sure if I was ready, but doing it, like, it went really smoothly. Originally, I had planned on, like, working with cameras, or I really like lighting, too.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do DP work, but I kind of just tried it with Dad one time, and then I noticed I had a really natural knack for it growing up around guns my whole life. Mm-hmm. So now I've come to realize, I'm like, oh my God, like, this is a pretty sweet gig.
Gutierrez-Reed prepared the gun, but she may not have loaded the live round that Alec Baldwin fired. And there is one heck of a story behind that one, as broken by The Wrap. A source close to the film told The Wrap that just hours before the shooting, but sometime after the guns had been prepared by the armorer, members of the film's crew had taken several prop guns out to go plinking. Plinking is a hobby in which people shoot beer cans with live ammo. According to the source, the gun fired by Alec Baldwin had been taken out to shoot off live ammo for fun. And now joining us is Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Her outlet broke this news. Sharon, it just defies logic. Are you joking me that it is true at this point that someone on the set or some people had taken those prop, real guns, they're props, but they're real guns, to go out and have some fun with real ammunition?
That's what our source is saying to us. We've asked the producers of the film whether it's true. They have not responded to that directly. They just gave us their stock statement that they're cooperating with the police and they're investigating what happened. So there's a lot of very disturbing things that we have been able to uncover as to what was going on that set as we've peeled away one layer after another layer with the notion that there are so many protocols in place to keep people safe on sets, that there's this overriding question of how could this possibly have happened, or this is impossible, this could never have happened, and yet it did. That additional piece of the story is really quite shocking.
So let me just show a couple of things that the investigators seized in this particular case. Three revolvers, nine spent casings, ammunition, which was loose and boxed and in a fanny pack, 14 swabs of suspected blood. Now, what I'm also curious about is that the DA said that there were multiple bullets. It's a bit weird the way that they actually termed it. This is how the Santa Fe DA termed it. There were an enormous amount of bullets on this set, and we need to find out what kinds they were. But what I'm shocked about is not only that there were an enormous amount of bullets, maybe that refers to what was in the boxes and the fanny pack and all the rest. There's not supposed to be any bullets. Like, there's blanks, yes.
Right.
Casings, yes. Bullets, which go on the top of the cartridge, zero. So this could be an extremely dangerous development for those who could be responsible for having a part in passing that gun around.
Yes. I mean, I think there's a little bit of lack of clarity. When I see references like that in the paperwork, which you're referring to, I want to be able to ask more questions, which they haven't answered. Do you actually mean live bullets? Because that's what it sounds like, or casings of live bullets, which, you know, every expert who we have spoken to, and I've gotten a crash course in this topic. I'm certainly no expert in it, but I've talked to so many experts, and our reporters have talked to so many experts since last Thursday, and they all say there should not be live ammunition on a set ever. And that, you know, again, as I said before, that there's this kind of thing should never have happened. One of the things that we also reported exclusively today, not that it brings us any pleasure whatsoever, is that the young woman who you just mentioned, the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, actually was the subject of complaints on the previous film that she was on. So despite what she was just saying, as you quoted in that podcast, there was a demand that she be fired off of that set, and we have that on the record from somebody who's called the key grip. That means the person who's in charge of making sure all the equipment's in the right place. That person was very disturbed to see this young woman handling guns in a way that he considered not safe. And there were two occasions when she discharged a weapon on the set of another Western. It was in Montana. It was about 2 months before Rust, a Nicolas Cage movie. And the first time it went off, you're supposed to announce when a weapon's going to be discharged, and she didn't do it. He got upset. And then the second time, she did it again 2 days later, and Nicolas Cage was very close by, and he got really upset and then stormed off the set and, you know, used an expletive that we quoted. But after that, this key grip who spoke to us said that he went to the first AD, assistant director, and said that she needed to be fired off of the movie. It did not happen there. And then she went on to take the job on Rust just a couple of months later.
Well, I dare say that you're going to be a guest again, because I know that The Wrap is going to find more remarkable breaks. It's an incredible story that you broke. Sharon Waxman, thank you. Appreciate it. Really do.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, if history had only taught its valuable lessons, this tragedy might not have happened. Sarah Jones was killed on the set of Midnight Rider in 2014, and her tragedy launched a campaign to make sure it would never happen again. So why did it? Sarah's father, Richard Jones, joins us next with the lawyer who fought for justice for Sarah. In 2014, Sarah Jones was on her way up in the movie business. She was 27 years old and working as a camera assistant on the set of a movie called Midnight Rider. The movie called for a dream sequence, and the plan was to steal the scene because they didn't have permission to shoot on the train trestle. The crew waited for two trains to pass by, and thinking they had plenty of time to get the shot, they made their move. But a third train barreled down the tracks, and Sarah was struck and killed. The director of that film ended up going to jail, and 11 people were held responsible. Sarah's parents launched the Sarah Jones Film Foundation to help foster awareness and accountability. Her dad, Richard, is with us tonight, along with the attorney who fought for justice in this case, Jeff Harris. Thank you to both of you for being with me. And I'm sorry it's under these circumstances, Richard, because this has to bring up a lot of memories for you, but also be frustrating to see that something so seemingly reckless could have happened in the Baldwin movie.
Yes. To be truthful, I had hoped that Sarah's death would make a difference. And I'd hoped that Sarah's death would even save lives. And I would have hoped that Sarah's death would have saved Helena, but it didn't. And that hurts.
So, I mean, we're not as close to this issue as you are, clearly, having lived through this. But many people want justice already without even knowing anything other than the base facts in this case. I'm assuming you probably feel the same way, that perhaps there should be some serious criminal accountability in this, Richard.
I do believe that, well, first of all, I do think or caution that we should let the investigation unfold and determine as best we can what the facts are. And in doing so, find those that are responsible for her death. And then we absolutely need to hold them fully accountable.
And Jeff Harris, fully accountable can mean so much to so many people. In the case of Sarah, the director, Randall Miller, pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter. He spent a year in jail, and 11 people ultimately were held responsible in civil findings. Do you see the same kind of sort of course potentially playing out, even at this early stage, hearing the things that you've heard from witnesses so far?
Good evening. I absolutely do. I mean, this the description of what was going on the Rust set is eerily similar to a lot of the things that was happening on the Midnight Rider set. And I do believe that you're going to have a potential case here that involves civil negligence, which means that somebody wasn't acting reasonably on a movie set. And I also think there's going to be a criminal case. And criminal cases typically rely on gross negligence or criminal negligence. And the things that I've heard and the descriptions of what was going on that set lead me to believe that someone is going to be charged with a crime for being criminally negligent. You just don't have firearms laying around on a cart that people pick up. And you don't have, as one of your guests said earlier, you don't have live ballistic rounds on a movie set. I mean, it's just inconceivable that could happen. And for someone to be injured when that takes place, it's clear to me that there was a systemic failure on the part of the production company to have sort of a culture of safety. And that's really what Sarah's case was all about, was trying to remind the industry and empower people on movie sets that you've got to have a culture of safety. You got to do it every day on every shoot. Otherwise, something terrible happens like this. And unfortunately, I think that, I believe the DA tomorrow is going to probably tell us a little bit more, but I think somebody's probably going to get indicted.
And there is a news conference planned for tomorrow. So, Jeff Harris, we're going to be watching along with you, and Richard Jones will be watching with you as well. I'm not even going to let you go until I let people know who are watching. If you want to read up more on Sarah and the effort to promote safety on the set, please check out safetyforsarah.com. It's the foundation that her parents set up. And as Richard said, to try to make sure what happened on the Alec Baldwin film would not happen again. But that is some good reading. Richard and Jeff, thank you so much. Coming up, it seems so simple. Why would an actual loaded gun even make its way anywhere near a Hollywood set? Coming up, we're going to talk to the sheriff. He's going to explain what might be going on right now next door in the neighboring state in this investigation, step by step. That's next. For the people who witnessed the traumatic shooting death of the cinematographer on the set of Alec Baldwin's movie, their nightmare is only just beginning. When something like this happens, there is a massive investigation, sometimes criminal charges, sometimes even a trial. And all of those witnesses play a part. So do the defendants, the people alleged to be responsible for the crime. So that is likely going on inside the Santa Fe Sheriff's Department right now. Really curious what questions are being asked. Who's lawyering up? Joining us now is Sheriff Mark Lamb of Pinal County, next door in Arizona. He is the face of the American Sheriff Network. What is happening now in terms of the investigation? Just step by step, take me through this. Were this your jurisdiction, Mark?
Well, we know who the shooter is, and that's Alec Baldwin. You know, in the end, we can make excuses for him, and we can blame other people that they should have unloaded it. Rule number one of firearms is all firearms are loaded. In the end, he is the responsible person. Now, can we attribute some of that negligence to other people? Sure. And that's what they're going to start looking at, going to start investigating, interviewing other people, witnesses. It depends on Alec Baldwin's behavior. Was he fooling around? What type of behavior was he going through when this happened? There's so much to look at here. So many interviews to be had. They're going to talk about the uncomfortableness that some of those other people had. So there's a lot going on.
So these pictures that we're showing right now are Alec Baldwin at the sheriff's detachment. He was doing interviews right away. He came in right away and spoke with them. He changed out of the costume, which was blood spattered, put on the street clothes, and he went, you know, to talk to the sheriff. My guess is that he wouldn't have scrambled a lawyer that quickly. But as you say, he could be culpable not only as the shooter, but also as a producer. What about all the others? Are they holding everybody in that state, saying, don't you move, we have to interview every single person who was on that set?
I mean, they could be. You know, they are going to interview everybody. But I got to go back to it. The culpable person is Alec Baldwin. He pulled the trigger. He had the gun in his hand. And that's really the primary thing here. Now, like I said, they're going to interview people to see what extent they involvement they had, negligence. I doubt they're holding everybody from the set there in the state.
So my curiosity is that actors are handed guns all the time. It's part of their role, and they're not the ones who are supposed to, you know, look into the barrel and all the rest. I hear what you're saying about pointing the firearm, but it almost makes me wonder, and this would be insult to injury for the director, Joel Souza, in this case, but he's responsible for that set overall. But he was injured in this. Is it possible he could also be charged?
I doubt they'll charge him, to be honest with you, Ashley. And look, in the end, it's firearm handling. Whoever has the firearm in their hands, it's their responsibility to triple check what other people have said. When we go to a range as a police officer, mind you, imagine if this role was reversed and this had happened on a police range. They would be just hammering the cop who handled the gun, even though somebody told him it wasn't loaded. So in the end, whoever handles the gun, actor or not, it's your responsibility to ensure that gun is not loaded.
Yeah, and they do take the safety class beforehand. Sheriff Lamb, thank you. I know you're busy tonight, so we'll let you go. We appreciate you taking a quick moment for us to help us sort of sort through this. It's always good to see Mark Lamb. It's so great to have you, Sheriff Lamb. So coming up, he is a broken man to be sure, but Alex Murdaugh is not, for the moment, broke. Remember I said for the moment, because like everything else in the Murdaugh, once enviable, once Teflon-coated life, that too may be about to change, and I'm going to show you how. Next. Welcome back. It has been a pretty rough 5 months for Alec Murdaugh. And before we break down just how huge an understatement that is, can you believe it's only been 5 months? Actually less, since we all came to know the Murdaughs and their crazy quilt of scandal. Anyway, since losing his wife and younger son in a brutal double murder, Alex Murdaugh has lost his job, his career, his good name, his legal standing, many, but likely not all, of his secrets, and most recently, his freedom. He's now spent a week in a jail cell on fraud charges stemming from the death of the family housekeeper and the insurance shenanigans that followed. But Alex Murdoch may be about to lose something he has spent his whole life acquiring, his money, his property, and his assets of every type and description. On Friday, a judge will hear motions filed by three of the Lowcountry lawyers currently suing Alex Murdoch for one thing or another. They've teamed up to ask the courts to freeze the assets of both Alex Murdoch and his son, Buster. If they succeed, one of the lawyers says Murdoch won't be able to buy a cup of coffee. And that lawyer is Eric Bland, and he joins me now live from Columbia. Okay, Eric Bland, that's tough, the cup of coffee thing. Did you guys go for the freeze action because, like, the report came out that Buster was up with Uncle John in Vegas, like, at the blackjack table? Did you start to worry about all the things that might go with the gambling and the boat sale and the mortgages and all the rest that are being satisfied?
Well, the casino trip was just icing on the cake. I mean, I can't imagine that they would have gambled away millions of dollars. But since his Labor Day arrest, Ashley, he has been a busy man with his son in trying to either transfer money, sell property, give his power of attorney to his son, Buster, so that I guess he could protect some of his money going forward to use to live, to help him with his legal problems, and maybe give some money to Buster. But enough's enough already. Since about 2015, I don't know when this guy has had time to practice law because he was too busy stealing.
Looks like he's recently listed a $115,000 boat. He's executed a satisfaction of a mortgage. He sold his share in a hunting club. The psych report's coming out soon, and apparently if the psych report is in his favor, he could be granted bond. Do you expect that'll happen, Eric?
Well, we would again hope that we have an opportunity to argue against him getting bond and that he should still remain incarcerated at this time. You know, it's up to the state to determine whether the psychological evaluation that's done by his lawyers is something that they should go with or they should order an independent medical exam. We're not really part of that, but we still feel he's a clear and present danger, Ashley, that he's already committed a crime with a gun. He's committed crimes with a pen against our client, against his law firm. And he seems to continue to commit crimes with a pen by having his surrogate, his son, do those in his name.
Eric Bland, it's always good to talk to you. I should let our viewers know that you've reconciled your differences with Alex Murdoch's law firm, so that part of it's gone away. But we're going to have you back as things continue to develop this week. Thanks, Eric.
Yep, we're turning our attention to the banks now, Ashley, and they will be the object of our affection.
6 seconds left, so I got to say goodbye. Thanks so much, Eric, and thank you all for joining us tonight. We'll see you tomorrow night on Banfield.